The following episode of Bookmark was first broadcast December 3rd, 2024. All right, good afternoon and welcome to Bookmarked on KZSM.org, your true community radio station where I know the nice man just told you, but I'm telling you again. And today the book under discussion is Fat Vampire by Johnny B. Truant. And my guests are Johnny B. Truant himself and Blake Farrar, who is, what, the world's greatest living Johnny B. Truant expert?
Big fan, huge fan.
Okay, the big fan, huge fan will do. So Johnny is the best-selling author of this, which has been adapted by the Sci-Fi Network as Reginald the Vampire. His other books include Pretty Killer, Gore Point, Invasion, The Beam, Dead City, Unicorn Western, and over 100 other titles across many genres, including both fiction and nonfiction, which is very interesting. In addition, Johnny is one of Indie Publishing's original authority. He's the creator and former co-host of the original self-publishing podcast, along with Sean Platt and David Wright, as well as the author of the indie cornerstone guide, Write, Publish, Repeat. Originally from Ohio, Johnny and his family now live in Austin, where, according to his website, he is finally surrounded by creative types as weird as he is.
Absolutely.
Is there anything to add to that?
Nothing to add. I made that bio long enough.
Okay. Blake Farrar teaches political science at Texas State, and as I said, counts as an authority because he's read most of Johnny's books. Anything you want me to add about you?
Well, technically, I'm on my 13th book. So
you're 13. Well, that's...
Most.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm on my way.
Okay.
On my way.
All right. Johnny, sort of begin at the beginning. How did you get started writing?
I've always wanted to be a writer. I know a lot of people in indie publishing who got into it because it was an interesting business opportunity or something, but I've always wanted to be a writer since the day of where the only option was to submit query letters to literary agents. Mm-hmm. And it's just something that I always dreamed that I could do, and after not being able to make it work in traditional publishing, I kind of gave up, went to grad school, circled back when digital self-publishing became a thing, and kind of haven't looked back.
Oh, okay. Because I knew you'd gone to graduate school in science and not mm-hmm. in writing, mm-hmm. so I thought, most people who write do say that, you know, that they've always wanted to be a writer.
You know? It's interesting because you mentioned that we had the self-publishing podcast and Write, Publish, Repeat. We had a conference for 4 years in Austin. And the number of professionals that we ran across, a lot of doctors and lawyers, who said, boy, I really wish I could quit doctoring or lawyering and write. Mm. It was a really common thing.
Yeah. All right. And how have you managed to write so much over a relatively short period of time? I mean, your first publication was in something like 2007, right?
It was 2012 when I wrote Fat Vampire, I believe. Mm-hmm. But I did write a book previously that didn't get published until around that time.
Oh, okay. So this was your first...
It was my first book that I wrote without taking a decade to marinate on it.
Oh, okay. So how did you manage to write so much in a relatively short period of time?
So that question is I'm just kind of chuckling to myself because in my world, it's really not that much.
Oh, really?
Right. In the traditional publishing world, it is. It's a lot. And the pace of writing in the indie world has really sped up to the point that it's a little obnoxious in my mind. Mm. I tend to be a fast writer just in general, but one of the things I found was when I tried to slow down, it became harder to do.
Mm-hmm.
The speed is how I get into flow.
Yeah, I see what you mean, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. A lot of your work is in collaboration with Sean. I assume that he pronounces his name that way.
Platt, Sean Platt.
Sean
yes.
Platt, yeah. How does collaboration work? You're like the third collaborative author mm-hmm. that I've ever talked to, and it's always interesting to see, you know, who does what. And one pair, Steve Davis and Bill Minutaglio, I think is how he pronounces his name, and they did like two books together. And then I asked Steve about it, and he said, well, we're not doing any more because we want to save the friendship. Would you talk about...
Yeah, absolutely. So Fat Vampire and there's just two or three others. That's a series. So all those books and two or three others are the only ones that I've written completely on my own credit. And my collaboration with Sean is a little different than other collaborations I've run across, and it's honestly the only way it would work for me. Mm-hmm. Because I don't consider myself a collaborative author, ironically. I can't share the steering wheel. Mm-hmm. So the way that we work is oftentimes Sean will come up with kind of a big picture, a world, a story he might like to tell, a bunch of characters, and then we discuss them. We'll have a meeting. I'll ask him a ton of questions as if that world really exists. Well, how does this work in that world? How does that work? And we'll adjust, and then we get to a point where we say, okay, go. And then I write the first draft from start to finish. Mm-hmm. And often we'll discuss along the way, and he'll read behind me and say, okay, well, how would you like to address this next thing or something? But I am the one doing all that first draft writing. Mm-hmm. And then I produce a pretty clean first draft. So Sean will go through and kind of spruce it up, make necessary edits, clean out the places where I'm kind of clearing my throat. And so we go in turns, basically. I know there are people who write discrete sections of a mm-hmm. book, but we don't do that. I write the entire thing, and then he'll go after me.
Yeah, but he generates that first, as you say, alternative world or whatever it is that you are the germ that you start with.
Right? Yes, in a lot of cases, the caveat that I would add that I think is kind of interesting is that it almost doesn't matter what that initial world is, because there have been times when we've had a complete story mapped out and I have started writing it and then immediately diverged and not even looked at it. But knowing that I have somebody there sometimes really helps.
Yeah. So how is the writing you do alone different? It sounds like it's not much.
No, it's actually very different.
Oh.
Which is interesting because I just discovered this recently after kind of reverse engineering my own process, is when I start working with Sean, having all that background is nice because I can delve in and out of it and pick and choose what I want to write. But when I'm writing by myself, it's actually a detriment to have too much information ahead of time. I actually need to strip way down to one or two characters, an overall idea of what it would be. So for Fat Vampire, it would be an overweight guy, you know, becomes a vampire and then doesn't fit in with the other vampires. So like that level. And then I just need to get to the inciting incident, the place where it happens. And if I have more than that, it actually messes me up.
That's fascinating. You told me you write genre fiction, and you said that genre fiction is not what I usually do on this show, which I guess is true. although I have talked about mysteries and even children's books occasionally, but. Would you talk about kind of genre fiction and the different, are there different audiences for, are there people who just love to read about vampires and people who love to read about zombies and things like that?
Yes.
Blake is nodding.
I'm nodding, yes.
Yeah. What's your perception of that, Blake? I'm sorry to pass the mic, but I'm kind of curious. You do read all over the place.
I am all over the place. And I think my brother, he's hardcore into science fiction, fantasy, but my interests kind of spread all over the place. I'm a big Western fan. I think because it's simple, there's kind of like true morals, and there's always a good guy, bad guy, but I love fantasy. And so the first time I met Johnny, we were talking about him being an author. He was talking about Unicorn Western and how it kind of brings the genres together, or is like non-genre. It's kind of fantasy, Western. It's about a guy who rides a unicorn and shoots a gun with pink smoke. And I was going through this massive Louis L'Amour phase and Cormac McCarthy phase, and I was fascinated by how you could have a fantasy Western. And so that's the first book that I ever read. So okay. I think there are people who like specific genres, like my wife. Mm-hmm. She wants that kind of that modern romance, you know, the kind of little raunchy romance these days.
Yeah. Ones with the thermometer on them.
Yeah. The ones that are not safe for public radio.
Yeah.
But I'm fascinated by Johnny because I've read so many of his books and they don't fit neatly into genres, and he has so much range that, I mean, I think there's almost something there for everybody.
You know? Well, thank you, Blake.
I believe it.
Yeah, that was that's quite a compliment. Yeah, I know what you. So it's something about his writing, but not any one genre. I mean, I know what you mean about my. I was bound to admit this sooner or later that my chosen genre is mysteries, and particularly mysteries by women writers with women protagonists, although not exclusively. And I do read so-called literary fiction sometimes, but, you know, to relax, it's always a mystery, and I don't do a whole lot of other genres, so I kind of admire you. But there was something about his writing in general that you like.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it's very unpredictable, I feel like. And some of the themes are really off the wall, very modern. Like, I've read probably 50 Louis L'Amour books, and there's, like, a formula, and they almost become predictable, but it's like none of Johnny's books fit a similar formula, right? They're always something that's a little kind of unexpected.
Well, can I ask you what you expected with Unicorn Western? Because I'm guessing it's not what you got by the end.
I did not expect it to be as deep as it was, because it is really philosophical and, like, spanning time and space. It's really kind of mind-opening, and I was not expecting it to be as well-written and thought out as it was. Because when I started reading, I was like, okay, this is kind of going to be a fun book. And it was a fun book, but it's also a very thoughtful book. That's kind of what I was most impressed with. And it's funny, too. Johnny's really good at putting in humor, sarcasm, right? Keeping a light note on some serious themes, I think.
Yeah. So one more genre fiction question occurs to me, and that is there a certain element? I mean, you're talking about the pleasures of the unexpected, which certainly, but is there a certain element of predictability? I mean, I I'm talking about my Westerns that I read, and I pretty much know that the protagonist is not going to be killed, and that we will probably find out who the killer, the murderer is, even though, and sometimes that person is not necessarily brought to justice, but we, the reader, know who it is. And I expect those things, and I think that's part of the pleasure of reading it, is that I get this comfort. But is there that element in... let's see, who do I want to ask this
to? Well, I have an answer to it.
Okay, well, yes. All right, so
yes.
I'll ask you.
So I actually kind of have two answers to that. So the one thing that I would say is that one of the definitions I've heard of genre fiction, and this is, I'm sure, not all-encompassing, but it does tend to be a general rule, is that genre fiction tends to take place in a world where justice is served. The good guys get what they deserve, and the bad guys get what they deserve. And there's an implicit reader promise with any genre expectation that if you don't fulfill it, yes, you're being an artist, but you're also disappointing a bunch of readers. Now, that said, I think that there are a lot of switchbacks and reveals that can happen within the confines where you aren't breaking that contract with the reader. And those things, I think, happen a lot in what I do, in large part because I don't know what is going to happen. So those things surprise me, and I know that if they surprise me, they're absolutely going to surprise a reader. And my wife tracks everything. She's never surprised in movies or books, but I've surprised her, and so that's how I know that I'm on the right track.
Yeah, I like what he said there, and I think that there is some satisfaction you get as a reader when you're trying to predict what's going to happen, and you're like, oh, I knew that was going to happen, right?
Yeah.
But then when the unexpected happens and you're kind of shocked or surprised, that's, I think, a completely different feeling. But since you're so into the mystery fiction, I think that Pretty Killer would be right up your alley, because that one is completely, in my opinion, kind of a true crime style mystery thriller, kind of psychological thriller, and you're always guessing. There's so many layers that you're always trying to guess the plot, and I don't think I was ever able to kind of figure it out until the end, honestly.
Yeah, I'm usually, I mean, sometimes they kind of, some mysteries will do a thing where the reader gets the clue before the protagonist does, but I don't think you would do that.
Well, I mean, I think that part of the balance of mysteries, especially mysteries, but thrillers as well, is it's nice. Readers like to feel smart. We all do. And so allowing a reader to solve a few of the mysteries successfully is, I don't think you want to surprise everybody 100% of the time, because then it's disorienting.
Yeah. And I was going to... Go ahead.
Do you intentionally mislead people? Do you, like, leave little threads to try to just...
Oh, yes.
Maybe drop
100%
ideas?
You do, yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, that's part of the fun for both writer and reader,
right.
I would think.
Yeah. 100%.
Oh, I know what I was going to pick up on that you said, that you don't know what's going to happen. I interviewed one mystery writer, I think it was Terry Shames, and she said she was the one who said, I never know who the killer is until I get there.
Mm-hmm.
And then I talked to somebody else, and she said, oh, well, I couldn't do that. You know, I'd have to plot it out. But but you just said that you don't know what's going to happen, you know. And does that mean that you don't know whether the protagonist is going to prevail or?
No, I think the protagonist, sorry, spoiler for pretty much all my books, the protagonist is going to prevail.
Well, it's genre
yeah,
fiction.
Yeah, or... they're going to prevail. But there are always surprises. So I think one of the things that what Blake said about Unicorn Western, and it's true of Fat Vampire too, what he kind of alluded to was the idea that it was this simple kind of funny book and then it becomes deep. That is just a natural thing that evolves out of starting with a very simple premise, like I was describing. I need a simple premise. And then I discover things. Mm-hmm. And in Unicorn Western in particular, in book 9, there's a game-changing revelation that occurs, something upon which the whole story hinges, that is seated back in book 4, but that I never planned it that way. Mm-hmm. It's just, well, there was a loose end that I could pull on.
Ah.
And it's, I like Stephen King's metaphor of the fossil. Have you heard this?
No.
So Stephen King said in his book On Writing that he doesn't believe that stories are created, that they're discovered. Mm-hmm. And so it's less like creating and building a thing and more like discovering a fossil underground.
Mm-hmm.
The writer's job is to excavate it and to try and pull as much from the ground intact as you can. And that's the way I feel. Mm-hmm. What's this story going to be as I start digging into it?
Oh, that's beautiful. I think I have... The next question I have to ask you is a little large, so to speak. So I think I will take our break, the break that I warned you about now.
Okay.
We'd like to remind you that KZSM is a 501c3 nonprofit supported entirely by grants, underwriting, and donations. Please use the donate button on kzsm.org to help us keep broadcasting the many voices of your community 24/7.
Bookmarked is brought to you in part by the Whitliff Collections at Texas State University. San Antonio has inspired generations of writers, musicians, and artists. Now, the city's creative currents are highlighted in a new exhibition at the Whitliff Collections. Spirit of San Antonio, drawn from the Whitliff's vast archival holdings, explores the city through many of its leading creative talents, including writers Sandra Cisneros, Rick Riordan, Carmen Tafoya, Naomi Shihab Nye, and many more. Also featured in the exhibition are selections from the extraordinary Ramon Hernandez Tejano Music Collection at the Whitliff, which includes treasured photographs and recordings from Tejano legends Selena, Flaco Jimenez, Sonny Ozuna, Steve Jordan, and more. Rounding out the exhibition are captivating images from celebrated photographers and artists weaving an unforgettable group portrait of this fascinating American city. On display now at the Whitliff Collections at Texas State University. For more information, please visit thewhitliffcollections.txstate.edu.
All right, welcome back to Bookmark, where we are talking with Johnny B. Truant, author of Fat Vampire and hundreds of other books of all in a whole range of genres, and also his, I don't know if you're the biggest fan, but one of his fans who is very knowledgeable about his work, Blake Farrar. About, you know, speculative fiction or sci-fi or pretty much anything that creates an alternate world. So even your Western is speculative with that unicorn.
Sure.
And I think you said he talks too, right?
He does talk. He's a real jerk.
Oh. Well, that must be... make things more difficult for the protagonist,
oh, yes.
Right?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Many comic misadventures.
Okay. But it seems to me that in speculative fiction, you get sort of two related dimensions. I mean, I've read the classics, and I like Octavia Butler a lot, that there's invention, which is just kind of bending reality, and what can you do, and how can you change or create a different world, that's in the bending reality is your phrase, and the other is what I guess I would call commentary, which is like a reflection on the world we live in or the culture we've mm-hmm. created. Not too long ago on here we talked about Celeste Ng's Our Missing Hearts, which is a dystopian book, I suppose in that sense speculative, but there's almost no invention. I mean, she doesn't try to create an alternate world. It's and that's part of what makes the book kind of scary, is it's just a little bit, mm-hmm. you know, this world a little more. You obviously combine both elements. So how do you, would you talk about kind of making that balance, do your various series differ? Are there some that are like more pure invention and some that are more what I'm calling commentary, for lack of a better word?
I think that one of the things that might make me a little more unique as a writer, I don't know if this is true, is because I do have a science grounding. So I actually started a PhD in genetics. Like, I have a lot of science behind me. And because of that, I can't suspend disbelief indefinitely.
Yeah.
And if I'm going to give you something fantastical, like a talking unicorn or vampires or zombies or something like that, I want to ground it as much as I can, because I'm asking you only then to take one leap, rather than to disregard a bunch of kind of things that I could just get right. I'm putting that in air quotes, get right. And that really bugs me when sometimes in sci-fi or something there will be just something that exists in our normal world that the author has just chosen to disregard. When if you ground that in what's actually true, then there's more veracity to the things that are fantastical. So as an example, my series Dead City is about, it's a zombie book, and I actually think you made reference to it. I call it a biological thriller that masquerades as a zombie book, because it's not really a zombie book. And the reason is because when I set out to write these zombies, so the premise is, just to give you an idea, it's that there was a zombie apocalypse, your classic zombie apocalypse, but then a drug was invented called necrophage, that what it does is it pauses the disease of zombieism wherever it is. So within, you know, if you got bit and then 2 days later you get necrophage, then you're just maybe a little forgetful or something. If you wait several weeks, then you're more like a zombie, and then when you go feral, then that's a problem. But because I was doing that, I talked to people, like I have friends who are in pharma, and I just went back to all of my science stuff, and I basically asked the question, well, zombies are ridiculous. Animating a body doesn't make any sense. But if it did, how close can I get? And so there's a lot of thought into how muscles would still move, and how a drug could stop it, and how there could something that goes wrong with the drug for a twist.
Wow. Okay. That's invention done amazingly.
Thank you. I will take that compliment.
Yeah. Well, I would appreciate that. Did you have anything to add on that one?
Yeah, it really comes out. And we were talking about this one day, I think, after a volleyball game. You were talking about how, or maybe it was at when we went to lunch that one time, you're talking about how much research you put into it. And it really does come across, I think, in Gore Point, the science background, and in the Robot Proletariat series, because it gets so, it's almost like Dune-esque, I think, is what I talked about, just how you're building this invention, you're creating this world, but it's based on science and facts. It might not be real science, some of it is, but how you can just build these theories that work in within that world, which is really
Dune
cool.
Dune is a great example. Dune is my classic. I always said I wanted to write a Dune, because Dune is this super fantastical sci-fi quasi-fantasy series.
Yeah, I've read it, but it's been a long time and I forgot.
Well, I just love that book. So at the end, there's an appendix called The Ecology of Dune, where Frank Herbert describes the sandworm life cycle and how they've terraformed the planet. I don't want to give spoilers, but there's sense to the sandworms. There's sense to the water scarcity on Arrakis, scientifically within the bounds of the world that he created.
Yeah, that's impressive. That to me, you were just commenting particularly about invention, but what about, are you trying to make a point or points with some of your fiction? And if you don't want to address that right now, we can just go ahead and start talking about it.
No, I'm happy to. Okay. The answer is that I don't usually do it intentionally, but my thoughts tend to come out just in flow. So I never set out to say I'm going to write a political allegory. So The Beam, for instance, is about this future world when there are two political parties, but that's just a facet of the world. And the political parties don't actually matter. Just a mm-hmm. little spoiler there. They're actually all this cabal that's, you know, we're going to give you a choice of here's how you can conform to us in one way, or here's how you can conform to us and be controlled by us in another mm-hmm. way. But there's no real difference there. It's the mm-hmm. illusion of choice. So that is a commentary, but I didn't do it deliberately. It's just something that came out of, I guess, my general cynicism about some of those things as I was mm-hmm. writing them.
Yeah. About human nature.
Yes.
Yeah. So you're writing to entertain and inform and maybe provoke some thought, but you don't know, but you're not sure what kind of thought, right?
Yeah, the entertaining always comes first. Yeah. I try not to be heavy-handed in anything that I do.
Okay. All right. Fat Vampire.
Yes.
Which I enjoyed, I have to admit.
Yay.
It tells the story of Reginald Baskin. Reginald is, I call him an alienated loner. I think that's probably
that's fair.
fairly mm-hmm. irrelevant. He works for a company that sells fitness equipment, ironically, of course. Mm-hmm. He becomes friends with Maurice. Maurice is a new employee, a 19-year-old goth, and he only works at night, et cetera, et cetera. And the reader is not surprised to find, given the title, that Maurice is a vampire. And he turns Reginald into a vampire, but Reginald has a little trouble adjusting to his new powers, and he doesn't really succeed in feeding. He resorts to hamburger, which is given to him. And that's part of the story, but the other part of the story is that both Reginald and Maurice are in big trouble with the Vampire Council because vampires are supposed to be perfect mm-hmm. and are supposed to, people go into training so that they'll be in perfect shape when they become a vampire, so that, mm-hmm. you know. But Reginald was not. In fact, he will always weigh 350 pounds. So Maurice is in trouble for creating him. Reginald is in trouble for being imperfect. And you have to read the book to find out, you know, about mm-hmm. that part. But anything else you'd like listeners to know a little bit about that book? Or,
well, I call it an undead underdog story is the way that I usually categorize Fat Vampire. Yeah. That's a fair summary. I'm going to save further commentary until you ask some questions.
Okay. All right. It's your best-known series. Is it your favorite or your best? Or did it just happen that it had that success? Or
It was my first after the book that I labored over for a dozen years. Mm-hmm. So it was my first real, like, as an author, publishing mm-hmm. book. And it just struck a chord. It is my wife's favorite. I do love it. There actually aren't any of my books that I don't like. I know that sounds. But it's not my favorite. Mm-hmm. Nothing against it. It just, I wouldn't have chosen it as my favorite. But it is my most popular. And what's interesting is that it's had a life of its own, despite the fact that I'm indie published, which means I don't have traditional distribution. It's found its ways into odd hands. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've been talking to like producers of TV or something, and they'll be like, oh, I found your book in an LA bookstore. Mm-hmm. And I didn't even know it was there. Mm-hmm. You know, that sort of thing happens. It's just, it's been downloaded and purchased so many times that something about it struck a chord, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Is it your favorite, Blake?
I wouldn't say it's my favorite. I'm on the third book of the series, and I think the second one, I think as it gets through the series, it does start to build layers. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't say it's my favorite. I think Robot Proletariat and then the Unicorn Western and the following one are probably my favorite. But I will say it's a very accessible book. I feel like it is one of the ones that probably would have the widest potential audience, maybe.
Yeah, it's fair.
And that might be why it is so popular.
Yeah, and why is that? Why would it have the widest potential audience? The question I wanted to ask is, you know, you write a vampire, an undead book, mm-hmm. right? To use the other term, and then you're writing into this really long oral tradition and literary tradition, and you've got Bram Stoker's Dracula and Anne Rice and the Twilight series. I haven't read those. I have read some Anne Rice. I used to read vampire stuff. I don't know. But, you know, was there something special or different about writing about vampires, and were you conscious of all of the stuff that's been written before?
Well, I wasn't trying to write into a tradition. It was more that a lot of my books and twists within my books have come out of some sort of logical consequence that I don't feel a lot of people have asked about. Mm-hmm. So this one came out of the idea that your body that you're changed with is the body you have forever. And we just accept that because that's what's in vampire fiction. But then I started to think about, well, what if this guy were changed? And then he's stuck forever. And there was a bunch of comic misadventure that happened. But not to spoil anything, but there's only so much vampirism to go around. And so the next logical consequence was if it didn't go into his physicality, it went into his mind. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of a things are deeper than they seem, or beauty is only skin deep sort of a thing that happened.
Yeah. Would you talk about writing about fat, which seems like a really delicate thing to do. I mean, do you read your Goodreads reviews?
No, I tend to stay away from
them. Yeah, I wouldn't blame you. But one person thought that the book was packed with fat shaming. Mm-hmm. But another one said, I'm a person of the larger persuasion myself, as he or she delicately mm-hmm. puts it. I'm very sensitive to the mockery of fat people, but that your protagonist was endearing and intelligent, and the physical imperfections weren't too often played for laughs. But I mean, the whole thing of he weighs 350 mm-hmm. pounds. And I think it was the same person who was concerned about fat shaming, was distressed because you suggested that Reginald was fat because of eating, and didn't take into account that there are other things that make people fat. Mm-hmm. So I mean, fat is a very awkward sort of topic. So how did you know?
It is, but one of the things. So just to begin with, one of the things that I think to be any sort of an artist, and even though I'm writing about overweight vampires, I do consider myself to be an artist to some degree.
Sure.
Is that I don't think you can be, I think you need to be sensitive to various issues, but I don't think you can be beholden to them to the point where you don't do what you're going to do. So I actually, after I wrote it, or while I was writing it, I ran the draft past some people that I knew who were a little bigger, and I mm-hmm. said, I'm kind of fit, you know, is this, I don't know, is this, it was like a sensitivity read.
Yeah.
And they said, no, it's great. Go ahead. And there have been a bunch of people since who've said basically that. Now, that said, I totally understand why people would have an issue, and I get it. As a matter of fact, when it was adapted to TV, there was somebody in the chain who didn't like the title, Fat Vampire, and that's why it became Reginald the Vampire.
Yeah, I wondered about that, if that was the case.
It was.
Although the actor is, I looked at some photos, mm-hmm. the actor is large.
He is. What's interesting about that is that throughout the series, the TV series, there were several times where they deliberately inserted the phrase fat vampire almost as a tip of the hat,
mm-hmm.
because everybody understood that that is a superficial complaint that is being levied against him by the most reprehensible characters in the book.
Right.
It's meant as an ironic title because they call him the fat vampire because that's all they see.
Yeah. Yeah, I certainly got that. You know, it seems to me the person who thought it was packed with fat shaming was, you know, pretty maybe a bit too sensitive.
Yeah, I think it's approachable because everybody has some characteristic about them that they are self-conscious of, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And you can relate to that. And in the story, he does deal with some workplace bullying, but the mm-hmm. one who's most conscious and most critical is he himself, you know? And so he's the one who's most conscious, where I don't want to give too much away, but the other characters are more accepting of, you know, his characteristics and looking at what is maybe unique and special about him, not what the title might suggest.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me if there are antagonists in here, it's the guys in the company, you mm-hmm. know, the... And I forgot to warn you that I like to read from the books, so a little bit from
oh,
a little
nice.
Bit from yours.
Love it.
Yeah. Almost the entire company was male in its 20s and in great shape as befitted a proper fitness company. The only exceptions were those who worked behind the scenes: Reginald, Sarah Kopke, Noel Leonard, Scott Valentine, and the new kid who worked overnight and dressed all in black. Everyone else looked alike and was more or less ready for a magazine cover shoot on a moment's notice, should the need arise. But everyone Reginald, Sarah, Noel, and Scott, and the new kid couldn't have stood out more than if they'd tried. And just like in high school, standing out, you know, the reasons are, let's see, Reginald is fat, Sarah and Noel weren't terribly attractive and were the wrong gender, Scott was in his 60s, and so on. They couldn't have stood out more if they'd tried. And just like in high school, standing out meant whoopee cushions on your chair or dentures and adult diapers on your desk, or if you were especially lucky, tampons in your coffee, you know. I mean, we know these are the bad guys, you know. Definitely. And also, you also point out that this little coterie of insiders, they were mostly apathetic about each other and about Reginald, but they were all united by their shared loathing of Walker and his clones. They would never say that Reginald was fat, mock his fat, or even comment when asked about him by a third party that he was fat. And Reginald, for his part, felt the same about them. Scott wasn't old, for instance. He was Scott, and he wasn't part of the army of clones.
The clones being all those identical guys with giant chiclet teeth, yes.
Yeah. I loved the chiclet teeth. You could sort of see him. Something, a little detail that I thought was funny was the beginnings of the friendship between Reginald and Maurice, which starts out with, let's see, what do they say? Hey. Mm-hmm. Hey. And then they say, what's up? What's up? And then they have what you call a bro date.
That's right.
Which is I'd never heard that phrase, but
it's kind of how me and Johnny met.
That's right. It's totally a bro date.
Yeah. Well, I mean, now that I've heard it, it makes sense.
Right.
But they go bowling, and then it goes.
You don't want to expose your emotions too much as a 40-something guy. Just
yeah. But I think it's nice that you even have bro dates. Most men are. Particularly, you get somewhat older like I am, and women have lots of friends, hang out. Men, not so much. You know, and that's generally true.
That's interesting. Yeah. I feel like I'm better at making friends now than I ever was.
Good.
Might be too.
Well, stay with it as you get older. Okay, both of you. Vampire culture turns out, speaking of, you know, the clones, vampire culture turns out to be nothing but an exaggerated mirror of this culture. And when they're in the bowling alley, they are accosted by what you call Maurice's own collection of Todd Walker clones.
Mm-hmm.
The group was comprised of two couples that appeared to be in their early 20s. All four were supernaturally beautiful. The women's hair, identical in style, though one was blonde and one was a deep chestnut, was perfectly groomed and styled, shiny and bouncy, seeming to move in a breeze that didn't exist. The cheekbones on all four were high and perfectly set. The men had a 16th inch of stubble that didn't look shaggy, but instead looked stylish and handsome. They were somehow both rugged and feminine, like they could chop some serious wood, but could do so without ruining their nails or knocking a hair out of their perfect cover model hairdos. Well, this is fun to read out loud.
Yes, yes, I should do it.
I have to say. But you want to say, you have any comments on the whole thing of making the vampires nothing but, you know, this sort of exaggerated reflection?
You know, every once in a while, I'll hear people reflect on how it must be so difficult to write and create because you have to do things like that. Think about, well, I'm going to compare this to that or whatever. And I honestly can't take too much credit. This is just how it comes out of me.
Mm-hmm.
But that idea of these perfect, pretty vampires, I find kind of annoying. There's a thing in the second book, which Blake has probably gotten to, where the point is made that vampires used to be ugly creatures of the dark, like Nosferatu.
Right. Yes.
And then they became this sparkling, beautiful thing. And that wasn't always that way. And Maurice, this is not a spoiler, but I think he's 2,000 years old, if I remember right.
Yeah.
So he remembers all those ways and is a holdover from, like, he has a lot of that knowledge of their species.
Yeah, so, yeah. Someone calls him, tells him he's old and irrelevant, or something like that.
Yeah, he's like a relic or something.
Yeah, even though he looks 19. Why do you think that? I mean, this is totally a rabbit hole, but I can't help thinking yes. about it. Why would that happen? I mean, the vampires in Anne Rice are pretty glamorous, if I remember.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but on the other hand, Dracula is kind of hideous and has hairy palms, which, you know.
Oh, I didn't know he had hairy palms. How about that?
Oh, yeah. Well, there are associations with that,
yeah, sure.
which you might be aware
of. I got some Cheech and Chong stories, I remember.
Yeah, you look like you're aware of. But why would they become glamorous?
Well, see, a lot of this, most of my unfolding, because I described that I don't really know what's going to happen, so mm-hmm. it's unfolding some way, and most of that comes from what's the logical consequence of what has already occurred. So when I think about, you know, we live in a capitalist world, we're always going to be trying to rake a little bit more out of any product and try to optimize a little bit, try to get a little bit more money. There's always this race to sharpen to some degree. And so it seems to me that if there was an elite status of people who were able to do whatever they wanted to do, then they would try to be better at doing what they were going to do. They would try to optimize. And this idea that you're fixed with the body that you have, it seemed very logical to me that they would train and they would beautify themselves mm-hmm. as much as they could before they hit pause. Yeah. And Reginald didn't get a chance to do that.
Yeah. I wasn't sure exactly why Reginald was at death's door. Was it because the two female vampires exsanguinated him?
Yeah, he was basically ready to die from bleeding to death, essentially.
Okay. That's what I thought, but I wasn't quite yeah. sure. And then Maurice had to save him by making him a vampire.
Yes.
Okay. We are already up on another break.
It's time to rock the holidays with Metal Mark Live and KZSM 104.1 FM. We're hosting our annual toy drive to support the San Marcos Southside Center, and we need your help to spread the cheer. Stop by 260 North Guadalupe Street and help us fill the Christmas tree in our window. Big or small, every donation makes a difference this holiday season. Brought to you by Metal Mark Live and KZSM 104.1 FM. Let's rock the holidays, one toy at a time.
Bookmarked is brought to you in part by the Whitliff Collections at Texas State University. San Antonio has inspired generations of writers, musicians, and artists. Now, the city's creative currents are highlighted in a new exhibition at the Whitliff Collections. Spirit of San Antonio, drawn from the Whitliff's vast archival holdings, explores the city through many of its leading creative talents, including writers Sandra Cisneros, Rick Riordan, Carmen Tafoya, Naomi Shihab Nye, and many more. Also featured in the exhibition are selections from the extraordinary Ramon Hernandez Tejano Music Collection at the Whitliff, which includes treasured photographs and recordings from Tejano legends Selena, Flaco Jimenez, Sonny Ozuna, Steve Jordan, and more. Rounding out the exhibition are captivating images from celebrated photographers and artists weaving an unforgettable group portrait of this fascinating American city. On display now at the Whitliff Collections at Texas State University. For more information, please visit thewhitliffcollections.txstate.edu.
Welcome back to Bookmark, where we are talking with Johnny B. Truant about his most famous of his over 100 books, Fat Vampire, and with his. You don't mind being called a fan, do you?
Fanboy is okay.
Blake Farrar. In fact, does Reginald grow in change? I mean, there does seem to be a point in Fat Vampire. Does Reginald grow and change?
I think he absolutely grows and changes, but it's more about acceptance of himself, I think. Because this is minor spoiler, but I don't think it's that big of a spoiler, is that he does have gifts that the other vampires don't have because they're so externally focused. This was that idea that there's only so much vampirism.
Mm-hmm.
And once he kind of comes to see that, oh, I can outsmart everybody,
yeah.
He has extensive mental and I guess they're yeah. all mental abilities that the others don't have. And to me, that's a growth arc for him, is to stop beating up on himself so much.
Yeah. And he also, there's also the point at which instead of feeling sorry for himself, he feels sorry for Claire, the child that he befriends because he can't bring himself to feed on her.
Yes.
Right. And tells her, discourages her from becoming a vampire. Tells her she grow up, it'll get better. I liked that. Isn't there a famous vampire named Claire? And that was.
I don't know. I keep thinking of Kirsten Dunst's character in Interview with a Vampire.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Action scenes. There are a couple of action scenes. One which I won't talk about because it's in the what I think of as the thrilling climax. But this one, let's see. Maurice, and this is Maurice who so far has appeared to be this skinny 19-year-old goth, right? Maurice says something. Isaac says something. These are the vampires who have come to chastise Maurice, I guess is a way to put it. Mm-hmm. Back, fear and anger mixed on his face pushes Maurice in the chest. This is the wrong thing to do. Maurice pushes back, but it's more like a strike than a push, and the noise is like a sledgehammer hitting a stake, and suddenly where Isaac was is not where Isaac is, and he's flying backward across the parking lot, striking a car, the car folding in half around him, broadside. The car, Isaac hybrid, then flying into a lamppost, which falls over in a shower of sparks. How do you manage to? How do you visualize stuff like that?
I love doing stuff like that. So first of all, you'll notice that was present tense as opposed mm-hmm. to past tense. I like the immediacy of it.
Mm-hmm.
I love writing action scenes. Action scenes and arguments, I just mm-hmm. absolutely love. There's something about getting in the flow of that that it's. I think in your notes that I read through, there was something about writing cinematically,
yeah.
And that could not be more accurate. I see something, especially in an action scene, and then I just feel like I'm describing what it is. Mm-hmm. And the words come faster than I can get them out of my fingers.
Huh.
It's just a flow thing. I just love getting into those. Those write faster than anything else.
Oh,
I think you're right. They're very cinematic, especially Robot Proletariat, a lot of action battle scenes. Mm-hmm. And gore point. That's honestly kind of one of my favorites because, in my opinion, it's like a dark Ghostbusters meets Stranger Things.
It's Backdraft with demons.
Yes, it's like that. And there's a lot of battles and actions and demons. And it is it's completely exciting. And what honestly, one of the things that I like best about his reading and any good author is you want a page turner. You mm-hmm. want something that's going to keep you moving yeah. those pages. And some of the chapters are shorter, and he has a great way of ending a chapter with a little cliffhanger that makes you sit there for hours, right? And there's been days where I've read an entire book in a day, just sitting there.
Yeah.
So that's one of my favorite things.
Sitting there and not
writing.
Taking out the trash or any of the other things you're supposed to be doing.
Oh, I take care of my business, but if I have time... I prefer to read.
Not well. I guess what I was thinking of was not grading papers.
Yeah, I prefer not to do that.
Having been there and done that.
Been yelled at many times for you made me late to work.
Yeah. So speaking of action and cinematic, how did you like Reginald the Vampire?
It's a different property is the way that I answer that. So I did enjoy it. Would mm-hmm. I have seeked it out if it hadn't been based on my book? Probably not.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a certain kinship to the material, and I've met all the people, and they're wonderful people.
Yeah.
And it's quite different in its, let's say, its less essential elements than from the books.
Mm-hmm. It looked like it was. I just read a description.
The core story is very much the same,
mm-hmm.
but the demographic is younger, and so for that reason they had to change a bunch, and it's TV, so they had to provide a bunch of alternate points of view to flip back and forth. So I sort of say that we both, me and the showrunner Harley Payton, it's like we had we both had this idea of this overweight guy being an undead underdog, and that was his version and this is mine.
Mm-hmm.
And I love it for that reason.
Yeah. Read the book for the best action scene in Fat Vampire, yeah, which also shows off Reginald's new brilliance. I like the one where he realizes he can play the piano, though.
Yes,
That was. I wondered if you were thinking about instincts, you know, I don't know, the little science I studied, the biology, you know, you learn about instincts and how they, and if you were thinking about that when he just sort of realizes that he can play the piano.
Yeah, I think I took that as an awakening of another non-intellectual property. I was looking for something. But those things, I was learning to play piano at the time, so that's the reason that came out. And then the time where he demonstrates his abilities by reading through The Shining.
Oh, yeah.
That's one of my favorite books. And so that's my copy of The Shining, where on that page, you know, different editions, but I pulled mine off my shelf, and all those references are to that exactly.
Yeah. Anything else you'd like to readers to know about Fat Vampire? I think they should probably read it.
Yeah, it's fun. I think they should read it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's fun and
it's very consumable. It's a short book, and it does have 5 sequels and a 4-book spin-off series and a prequel, but the original book is short.
Okay. All right. Your most recent book is Suicide Flats, which you say surprised you in a bunch of ways, and it was the first one you'd written by yourself for a couple of years.
Yes.
So you want to talk a little, how did it surprise you?
It surprised me in the way that that all of my books surprise me. So I just knew the basic premise, which was it was in an existing world. It was the Gore Point world that Blake has referred to. And I knew it was an origin story. There was this cover-up of this interdimensional rift that was at the bottom of a black lake. And the first first demon comes out of it and goes on a rampage. And that's basically all I knew.
Cool.
So I thought it was going to be a rampage story. But when I decided on the main character, I like to say, well, what does that story reflect off of best? What character brings out that the best? And so I ended up writing a minister. And so once I had him in play and he's kind of lost his faith, there was a whole sequence of events that occurred that formed the backbone of that story that I never, ever saw coming. Mm-hmm. But that happens every time. It's wonderful.
That's fantastic. It's fantastic.
That's not the choose-your-own-adventure, is it?
Not able to do that.
Okay, I was wondering.
And I could tell you why, but it would take more time than I imagined.
We'll talk about it over a drink afterwards.
Yeah, okay. We haven't talked much about your role in indie publishing, and you are about to... And I'm not sure whether this is a work in progress or whether you've already got it done and are just about to put it out, a book called The Artisan Author, The Low-Stress, High-Quality, Fan-Focused Approach to Escaping the Publishing Rat Race.
Yes.
Yeah.
So your listeners might not know that there is a publishing rat race.
Okay.
So this is a case where the indie publishing world is a little different from what I think a lot of people know about, especially traditionally published authors or those who read and know about traditionally published books. In the indie world, it's much more entrepreneurial. It's much more, we can create something and put it out right away. And so a lot of people do exactly that. And it's become this, to simplify it, it's become a kind of a grind where go faster, 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 and you're making less and less on your books. And so there are people who want to produce a book every 2 to 4 weeks, and they won't take a vacation because then they'll lose all their momentum because they're publishing into like the Kindle Unlimited ecosystem, which is this subscription service. And it attracts these whale readers who just, you know, they read really fast. And anyway, a lot of people are in that. Like I would say most of the authors have that mentality of faster, faster, I got to do all the things. And it's at a certain, you know, I've been in this for about a dozen years. I came back after kind of a hiatus, saw that that was more entrenched than it had ever been, and kind of stepped back and said, well, I don't want to be part of this anymore. I got into this for the love of storytelling, and I want to take my time. And so The Artisan Author is kind of a flip on that.
Ah.
It's more like people can download an MP3, and it's cheap, and it's fast, and it's, you know, the sound quality is great. But then there's people who want custom-pressed vinyl. You know, they want something they can touch and hold. And so The Artisan Author is that demographic of readers who want something that's different or handmade or that's taken its time, that's very human.
He's talking about me, because I'm a big fan of the paperback. And I'll spend so much time in front of a screen, whether it's the computer or my phone, that I want to hold my book, and I want to I want to turn the pages and hear the,
but also defying genre, you know, guidelines and stuff too. That's another thing.
That's just like the music industry, you're right. I mean, you know, I think the same pressures.
So there are people who I would take it don't want a physical published book, but just all read all of it, download it, read it off of, I mean, I use Kindle Unlimited, but it's for traditional books. And they devour things so fast that they demand more. I mean, I didn't know that many people read that much and that fast.
Yeah, a lot of people do. It's less about physical books versus e-books than it is about sort of a commoditized approach to publishing versus an artisan approach to publishing. So just about any traditional author is going to be on the latter side of that. Just about anybody you've talked to is doing it, and they're putting their heart and soul into it. But there's a certain, well, okay, I'm writing military sci-fi, and I have a military sci-fi series, so I guess I'd better write yet another series about a grizzled captain who was rejected from the Corps. You know, very much the same, because that's what the readers want. And my books are all over the place. I don't want to stick to one genre. I don't want to spit off things as fast as I can. I don't want a surface level beach read every single time. I want to do weird stuff and get deep. And that's what a lot of that is taking your time, as well as doing things like special editions and hardbacks and all that fun stuff.
All right. We have 4 minutes left. What else would you like our, thank you very much for talking to me. What else would you like our listeners to know?
Well, is this the part where I self-promote?
You can self-promote a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess I would just say that, I don't want to self-promote for 4 minutes.
Okay, well, I don't want to do 90 seconds?
Yeah, I don't want to do, so my site is johnnybtruantbooks.com, and I do have books at Book People. So I'm gonna be selling at the Galleria Holiday Market. I'm just saying that too.
You can get them on Amazon, I suppose.
Yeah. Oh, and you can get them on Amazon. Yes. Well, look at me being the artisan. I'm only giving you the fun, high touch stuff. Yeah.
I would encourage people to look out to the website though, because one, it is very visually stimulating. It breaks them down into different topics and genres, and I think you'll get a better idea of what you're purchasing if you go to the website, and you're also going to contribute more to the author himself instead of that middleman. So that's always what I like to do if possible.
I would just say that I feel so lucky to be able to do this for a living.
Oh, yeah.
It's something I've always wanted to do. And I get, maybe on an inspirational note, if there's any of your listeners who do aspire to write, it's easier than ever to be able to do that. Now, to do it with quality and to do it successfully, that's a little trickier.
Yeah.
And I'm certainly happy to answer any questions that may be sent your way as well. I'd like to help other authors.
Oh, well, that's good. And you have books about it, right?
I do. I do have extensive nonfiction offerings as well.
Yeah, and they're all on the website, which you're right. I looked at it. It is. It's very thorough.
It's cool.
All right. Next week, Jerry Whitus talks about his new short story collection, The Innocent and Others. And I just got a copy of it, so I can't tell you anything about it. I think it's his first. He's written other things, but I think it's his first book of fiction, which is interesting. So, well, Johnny B. Truant, thank you so much for coming and talking to me.
Oh, you are very welcome.
I
love doing
this. This was fun. And Blake, it was nice to see you again.
Thank you for letting me crash the party. It's been 14 months since I've been in here, so really cool to be back.
All right. And don't forget the toy drive, and thanks for listening.